The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello everyone, my name is Jim Smith and welcome to Recovery Today. My guest on this week's show is Nick Gurr. Nick's an old friend who's had his battle with alcoholism and he's been in recovery for many years. Whilst in recovery from alcoholism, he came to a crisis point where he had to look at other issues, and we're going to focus on that a while. However, Nick's led a varied life, so I'll introduce him and just ask him to talk a bit about his beginnings. Nick, would you do that?
Yeah, it's nice to be here, Jim. And as you say, we have known each other a long time and done a lot of sharing between us over the years. And it's great to have this opportunity to talk about some of the things that aren't talked so much about in the recovery community. Yeah. And but I'll start at the beginning because it's the best place to start. And just to say, I was born just over 50 years ago. I was born in the United States. My father was an academic who was working at Harvard University at the time that I was born. And he had, you know, he had big dreams for me, I guess. You know, he wanted me to follow in his footsteps, I think. And, you know, I think often parents or anybody else, our friends even, don't really see us as we really are necessarily, you know, and so I wasn't really suited for the kind of life that he envisaged for me. I was a different person to that. So I grew up feeling somewhat out of sorts. I'm very grateful for my family background. It introduced me to a lot of good stuff. There was always books, there was always music, there were concerts to go to, and this sort of thing. And it's a very loving background in many, many ways, but there was this kind of expectation of success, of the priority of intellect, I suppose. You know, and that meant I didn't focus on other areas of my personality which might have been more useful to me, really. Might have been more in line with who I was. So there was always that feeling of, well, A, not feeling good enough, B, always feeling in the wrong place at the wrong time, that I should be doing something different, that I should be doing something more constructive with my time, that I should be doing better at school, that I should be concentrating on my academic life.
Did alcohol relieve you of some of those pressures? And
Oh absolutely it did. It was like a spiritual experience, really. I'd have to say when I discovered it around about the age of 13, it made me feel at home in the world in a way which I had never done before. You know, and that's not anybody's fault. It was just the way it was. But alcohol seemed great. And not knowing what I came to know later, that alcoholism was a progressive disease, that it was going to get worse, that it was going to take away a lot of the things that I valued in life, I didn't know any of that. So I'd have been a fool not to have another drink. And I I wanted to find more of it as soon as I possibly could, and that's the way it went. You know, there's really not much more to say about it.
And where did it take you? Where did it lead you?
Well, it took me out of into a world that I had no preparation for, really. It took me to a place where I damaged all the relationships that I had, that I couldn't form significant relationships in my life because my primary... where it took me was that my primary relationship was with a substance, or rather substances, because I didn't really care what I took. I was very reckless. Sure. As to my personal safety, you know, in yes, all sorts yes. of ways. And it took me, it made me, or it enabled me to drop out of college. Forced me to drop out of university. And I very quickly just fell through every net that was there. You know, I was too ashamed to go home, so I ended up homeless. I ended up mentally ill. I ended up in hospitals. And... it was no way of life for an 18-year-old, you know.
When did you seek help?
Oh, I sought help first in my first term at university. I knew at that point that something was horribly wrong, that I was free of the restraints of home and village life. And, I went completely haywire and realised that I was not prepared for the outside world. You know, I had neglected my personal development, really. And that's a personal development I've cultivated in recovery. So, that would have been the first time. That would have been 18. And, it just wasn't to take at that point. And I'd wait another 6 years. And the cycle just got... It just got worse. We know
things
what happens.
Progress. And eventually, you became abstinent
at age 24. And have been ever since. And that's been the primary driver of my life. Yeah. That's what I see. Everything else in that context, suppose. You know, that's the foundation stone.
Right at this point, I'd like to. Play your first selection of music, because as most of my guests, well, all my guests, and I think most people one meets in life, music's a very important part of what we do and what we hear. And just mention this, a couple of years ago, we took a trip, didn't we, in your old sports car down to Canvey Island.
We did indeed.
In Essex. It's very relevant for me because when I grew up in Croydon, my grandparents lived in Canvey Island, and I hadn't been there for years. So it was a kind of nostalgic trip for me. However, for you, it was slightly different.
It was a pilgrimage for
pilgrimage,
me.
Pilgrimage,
I'd never been, but one of my favourite bands, the first band I ever saw live, was Dr. Feelgood.
Yes.
And we're going to hear a bit of Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah.
But just to say, I discovered rock and roll about the same time that I discovered alcohol. Now, if I'd stuck with rock and roll, things might have gone better. Dr. Feelgood, they epitomise rock and roll for me. The sense of freedom and liberation. It's just terrific.
And what's the track?
It's called Going Back Home from the Malpractice album.
Okay.
A wonderful bit of music it is too.
Going Back Home by Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah.
that was Going Back Home by Dr. Feelgood. So, Wilco, the guitarist, the famous guitarist of that band, it's congratulations, really, isn't it, to him? He's just come through a huge health
issue. Absolutely. I mean, he thought that he was going to die. Yeah, and unfortunately, his life was saved from, you know, a very, very serious cancer. So so that's great for all of us, really, who love to go and see Wilco and his music. Yeah,
that's right. Okay, so we're at the point now, you're starting your recovery, like most of us in recovery, or perhaps all of us, we all have a spiritual quest, spiritual vision. But in your case, you actually did something concrete about it after about 6 years, is that right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think everybody that's in recovery successfully finds this spiritual dimension to their lives and starts to cultivate it and become interested in it. To me, it became an obsession, I'd have to say. I was going everywhere, to different churches, to different temples, to different teachers of meditation and this sort of thing, and eventually settled on the teaching of a Buddhist teacher down in Bradford-on-Avon in Wiltshire, and ended up going living in his centre for about a year. Right. I wasn't a monk, but I lived the life of a monk, I suppose. And I was, I was doing the cooking in a retreat centre. Basically, that was my primary job. But the real reason for being there was just being close to that teaching and learning about meditation and learning about the whole Buddhist system. It's not a path that I follow today. My path changed, but I'm very grateful for the opportunity that year gave me. It was it was quite something. In many ways, it came rather early in recovery. I was about 6 years sober, and it seemed like a very long time to be sober. Oh, of course it is, but actually, I hadn't really ironed out a lot of the difficulties that I had. And so I wasn't totally prepared for the commitment that kind of life. I've got a lot of respect for people who follow a religious path in life. I think it's a very difficult one. There's no sense in which people are running away from life or living in an ivory tower. If people go into it with that idea, they're going to be very sadly disappointed, I'm afraid.
Sure, that's right. Well, a bit further on in your recovery, you came to a crisis point, didn't you?
Yeah, quite a lot further on. When I came out of the meditation centre, I went back to the work that I'd been doing before, which was working in services for homeless people, and particularly with homeless people who had complex mental health issues. Mm. Now, when I came out of the meditation centre, the monastery, I had no intention of going back into that kind of work at all. But I needed a job. Somebody offered me a job without really me putting in any, the way these things go. Yeah. Well, the first day back, I met the woman who was going to become my wife. That was life kind of working out as it was supposed to. I went back into that kind of work, and I worked in it as I had done before, and not in a, I think I did help people, but it was at great cost to myself. You know, I tended to find the positions which the most extreme, really, doing outreach with street homeless people and working in a very busy homeless persons unit in London, and jobs which were very taxing, which demanded a great deal of commitment, and I wasn't mature enough to cope with that, really. And what was happening is I was getting my fix from the drama, from the adrenaline, from the just the busyness of it all, you know. Yeah. And that went on, and I found myself entering this cycle of working very hard, collapsing, taking time off, going back into it, working very hard, collapsing. And this cycle went on until finally I just had a complete breakdown.
Yeah.
Now, in that interim, not only was I doing this kind of work, but I was also trying to study at the same time. I was running the management committee of the place where I lived. I was operating in two separate businesses. I was working with people in recovery. I was doing lots of service towards my fellow alcoholics. It just went on and on, Jim. You know, it was just crazy. I was running retreats. You remember?
Yes, I remember that.
Come on the retreats.
So self-care really went out the window.
Self-care was completely out of the window, especially as, you know, the point of running a retreat is for people to go and take care of themselves. So there was a huge irony about it anyway.
Yeah.
An irony which I did not see at all.
Yeah.
And I think this is an issue for the recovery community, is that people can get suckered into doing far too much. And it has to be shared out. The load has to be shared out with people. And people like me tend to take on more than our share. So we're getting our fix of that, you know, sense of self-esteem, which should be coming from elsewhere. That should be coming from our, you know, from our spiritual life.
Mm.
So in the end, I collapsed, mate. You know, that that was how it went. And you saw me in that period.
Yes.
It was another rock bottom.
Yes, that's right. And it's almost another another rebirth. It seems that quite often we seem to have to come to a deflation, a rock bottom, before we can move on. And it's almost like a spiritual awakening when we do come through it, because it's led you to look at your workaholism, isn't it?
Absolutely, Jim. Yeah. I had absolutely no idea that I was a workaholic.
No.
It's quite easy, I think, to be disguised in this society as a workaholic. It's quite easy to... people didn't positively respond to my alcoholism, for example, my active alcoholism. It was a pain in the neck to everybody that came in contact with it. Now, my workaholism was not that. There were plenty of organisations which were quite happy for me to work well into the night and to do extra stuff without being paid and all the rest of it. They were quite happy to use that dysfunction. Nobody in my other recovery community called me on the amount that I was doing, on the amount of people that I was working with. So it was difficult for me to see it. But my denial was such that I knew that my wife had had a problem with workaholism. I was very pleased that she was getting help for her issues.
Yeah.
But it never struck me that this was an issue for me too. So there you were. And it all came to a head about 10 days after I'd celebrated 20 years of sobriety.
Right.
You know, I had been abstinent for 20 years, and yet this other issue had gradually manifested, and it just put me off onto another course. And since that time, which is almost 10 years ago now, it will be later in this year, that's been the thing that I've been looking at. Not so much the alcohol and substances and that sort of thing, but this more subtle thing of adrenaline addiction, of all or nothing working. It's a very difficult thing to tackle, because it's not like drinking or cigarettes where you're either doing it or you're not doing it. We all have to work in the society. It's like we all have to eat. So if you've got a problem with eating or working, then you have to find that balance. You have to find
And historically, and you know, there's this work ethic, isn't there, in this country, in the Western world, where we're encouraged to do as much as we can, really, and the more we do, we seem to be good citizens.
Yeah, very much so. I think family background was quite important in my case. You know, that had definitely been an ethic. You know, my father particularly was involved in a lot of things. Mm. You know, to his cost, I'd have to say.
Yeah.
But certainly, society, it will reinforce your commitment to work. It will say there are rewards for that. Mm. Well, there are rewards, and some people may be able to handle that kind of activity, but I wasn't one of those.
No.
Because I was always seeking that fix. I was looking to my work, to my identification with what I did, to fix something which was still broken in me, Jim, you know. There was a whole area of my life which I kind of shut off from, and that my work was making me feel important, it was making me feel worthwhile, it was giving me a reason to be, rather than, I suppose, what God wants, which is, it's a free gift, this life, you know, you don't have to do anything in particular with it, it's... just be, just do the next thing. You know, this is stuff that I've been learning in the last 10 years. And slowly, it's just come into line with all the stuff that I was taught in Buddhism, all the stuff that I learned from other religious traditions, the one that I'm involved with now, you know.
There seemed to be quite a pressure for you to succeed as a child growing up. How would you say, I mean, that impacted quite a lot on your life, didn't it? How would you see yourself now regarding that?
Oh, I think, you know, when you have these things like alcoholism and drug addiction, they're divine disorders, because if you can get through them and you do what you need to do to recover from them, then you will find your old relationships being healed. So the work that I've done in that and the changes that have come about in my family means that, you know, my relationship, say, with my father and my mother are healed now. You know, they see me for who I am, and that's just been a great blessing, really.
Yes.
Yeah, it really has. I think that's the message, isn't it, for anybody that's struggling with any addiction, is if you can focus on that, it widens out, you know, so that it just starts taking in all of your life, and it will all get healed. God will bring everything to good account, is my way of looking at it.
I'd like to mention Barcelona, Nick, or Montserrat. Was it 2003?
Somewhere about that period. because life was very, very busy at that time.
Yeah.
My recollection is a bit sketchy, but I do remember that being a very reviving experience, and one of the few times when I felt that I completely relaxed and I was able to let go, and I had that space in my life, and the kind of spiritual exploration that we did there, you know,
it was a wonderful time.
This
was
a special place,
a retreat stroke holiday, really. I ran near Barcelona, near the mountain Montserrat, in an arts centre, and I agree with you. They were good times for me. I felt really at one there, and it just went to show, didn't it, how, you know, recovery, you know, we can have a holiday in recovery and it's like almost in the fifth dimension, you know.
It is. I think the important thing about recovery is it's all about relationships. It's all about cultivating how we relate to each other.
It is.
Without the need for approval or success or achievement or anything like that. That's why I used to tell people on the retreats that I ran. There's nothing to be gained here. It's completely free. You know, you don't have to achieve anything. And that's the path of meditation. But it took me a while to take that on board myself, I suppose.
Which there's a connection here with music, because we played a lot of music in Barcelona and every night.
We certainly did, yeah.
And for your second choice of music, you've chosen a favourite of mine, a wonderful artist, Richard Thompson.
Mm.
And I know you've seen Richard Thompson many times.
Yeah, probably 30 plus times.
Yes,
live.
Yeah. I've seen him a few times, and Richard Thompson started his career really in a band called Fairport Convention, who are still active today.
Certainly are.
Still touring and playing. However, this was many years ago. Sandy Denny was the vocalist, and she's become quite iconic now.
Mm.
But this track you've chosen is off an album called Pour Down Like Silver, isn't
That's
it?
That's right. Yeah.
Richard and Linda Thompson. Yes,
yeah.
they were they were married for
about ten years,
and they produced some great albums.
Yeah, yes. Some really great albums in the 1970s, and I think Richard Thompson is a hidden gem of British music, still really not as well known as he should be.
Mm.
Fabulous guitarist,
yeah.
And maybe even better songwriter. I don't know. But Fairport Convention were really important to me. It was my first girlfriend introduced me to Fairport Convention from her dad's record collection.
Yeah.
And I just remember, this was fantastic.
Yes.
Especially the guitar playing.
Yeah.
I just thought it was extraordinary. So this track is called Dimming of the Day. I think it's one of Rich Thompson's most beautiful songs.
It is. I agree with that. Here's Richard and Linda Thompson singing Dimming of the Day.
Come the dawn. I see you on the street in company. Why don't you come and ease your mind with me? I'm living for the night we steal away. I need you at the dimming.
Dimming of the Day by Richard and Linda Thompson from their second album, was it, Nick?
Third album. But who's going to be for Nick?
Third album, Pour Down Like Silver. And there's been some wonderful versions also of that song with Richard Thompson and Bonnie Raitt. And I don't know if Mary Black ever did it with him. Anyway, it's a wonderful song. And it's a wonderful artist, Richard Thompson. Okay, so... what's it like for you today, Nick? What's life like today?
Well, quite different, really. I have arrived in a place of, at long last, of relaxation, of feeling comfortable in my skin. Yeah. If I had just suffered from alcoholism and drug addiction, then I might have found this... state somewhat earlier, but it's just been the road. We all have to take our own particular road, you know, and I'm really glad that I got to that point where I was forced to make some changes in my life. So, you know, the program that I work as regards recovering from work isn't very similar to the one that I work to stay abstinent from alcohol and other substances. But it's promoted a lot of changes, both in my attitudes and what I do.
Nick, is the program that you work today around workaholism, it's very similar, isn't it, to a program you would work anyway from alcoholism and addiction?
Well, very similar, Jim, really, because... I think it's all about spiritual growth. It's about recognizing this weakness which has been given to you so that you can grow into being a human being and not a human doing.
Yeah.
You know, something that we hear a lot in the recovery movement, but for me it became absolutely essential to accept myself as I was.
Nick, what kind of things do you enjoy doing? I know you're busy, you're working full-time. It's quite a physical job you do. So what do you do in your spare time? What do you enjoy?
Okay, well, the first point I'd make, given that we're talking about work and recovery from obsessive work, and this is the point that I was wanting to make, the addiction element of it is to a substance which you're creating yourself, adrenaline, and it's also addiction to a process of overdoing and wearing yourself out by that.
Yeah.
So it became important for me because I was so closely identified with what I had done as a career. 2 years into recovery from workaholism, I realised I had to change that. I had to change direction. I had to do something which actually didn't matter all that much to me. So I've been working with a friend as a decorator for the last 9 years, you know, and I didn't intend to do that for very long. It was just while I worked out, well, what was I going to do? And been there ever since. And we just enjoy life and enjoy our work.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that I'm completely depleted.
No.
So I can invest in my relationships. I can be a proper member of my family, and I can cultivate some other interests in life. And one of the best ones for me has been allotment gardening.
Yes.
You know, if you told my 20-year-old self that what I would most like to do at the age of 50 was to go to my allotment and dig and plant things and harvest crops, I would have probably had to kill you. But there it is. That's what I do enjoy doing. I enjoy being in touch with nature, and I'm getting interested in through the necessity of recovery from workaholism. I'm getting interested in life being much simpler, the impact that people like us in recovery can have on the world, you know, by living a more simple human life, I think. So that's really important. The other thing that I've got into in the last couple of years is wood carving. I found I found that a friend of mine had opened up a school teaching these old crafts, and I decided to sign up with him. Just on a whim, I decided I'd take a course with him. And I hesitate to say that I became addicted, but I kind of became addicted. But it feels like a really healthy thing to do.
Yes.
I think there's nothing like, you know, like you with your guitar and me with carving. That sort of craftsmanship of it gets you in touch with who you really are, you know, and that's... So those are the things that I really like doing, and the rest is really... investing in my spiritual communities, in my recovery communities, in my family community with my wife. And, we have a good life today. And that's really the only achievement that there has to be. I wish we could get across to people in recovery. There is nothing to achieve here except just to be. You know, it's as simple as that. Eat, sleep, hang out with people you like. I went out chasing. I didn't chase money so much, but I certainly chased prestige, and I chased good job titles, and I chased kudos and the approval of my peers and this sort of thing. And none of that is important now.
No.
It's just nice if a customer likes the way their lounge has been painted. Yes. That's quite enough for me, you know.
Yeah, that's so good. There's so much emphasis today, isn't there, on status?
Oh, very much
and
so.
And things.
Yeah.
I always quote this. I went into a rehab in upstate New York called Veritas Villas in 2011. And when you go in Veritas Villas, which actually translates from the Greek House of Truth, there's a sign above the reception, and it says the important things in life ain't things, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Before we close, because it's been an absolute pleasure to listen to you and, you know, to interview you today, Nick, and to know you as a friend, you have one last piece of music to choose, and it's not folk or blues, or it's from one of the men who started it all, really.
Would
you like to introduce it and we'll play out?
I would, and it feels appropriate to what we've just been discussing, actually, Jim. Finally in life I have enough, and this next piece of music is by J.S. Bach, and it's Ich habe genug, which means I have enough, I am content. And I'm playing this because it's such a beautiful piece of music, and it pays tribute to what my parents gave me, actually, a love of great music. And then I went out and I found my stuff as well, you know, Fairport Convention and Dr. Feelgood whoever it is, Charlie Parker and all the other stuff that I love. But they grounded me in a way in the things of the spirit and in things of art, both in literature and music. And I'm very grateful to growing up in a place where I heard such magic, really. Yeah, so I really appreciate talking to you today, Jim. It's been lovely for us to get together again.
It has, and thanks very much, Nick. Here's your final selection. Here it is, J.S. Bach. Thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.